Jesus takes Peter, James, and John up to the top of this mountain. And before they know it, he is just standing there. They are blinded by this white light that just seems to be, I don't know whether it's coming from him or emanating from him or whatever, but it leaves them terrified. In the book of Matthew and Mark and in the book of Luke, they're confused. So they're terrified and they're confused in the face of this light. And then all of a sudden there's Moses and Elijah, like these two prophets of Israel that are just kind of somehow standing there. And there's this voice that says, "This is my son, listen to him." What do we make of that text? We get to wrestle with it every year, fortunately. So we try to figure out what that means. Today, I want to talk about that text, but I want to view it through the lens of the psalm that we read today, Psalm 50. We often don't focus on the psalms, but they're part of our scripture readings. And this one, this week particularly, struck me. And so if I could have somebody take out the lights or turn off the lights so we can see the screens, that'd be great. Psalm 50 begins, "The mighty one, God the Lord, speaks and summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting." And the context is from the rising of the sun to its setting. It's meant to evoke that sense you have when you're in that blue hour in the early morning before as the stars slowly dim and the light grows this deep indigo blue and you see the first pink of dawn on the clouds, like the stillness and the sacredness of that moment and the beauty of that moment. From the beginning of that point and this day filled with light to that point in the evening when the light fades and the colors become rich in the yellow kind of yellow glow of the sun, right? And then the pink and the sunset and the beauty of the sunset. So from the beauty of the beginning of the day to the beauty at the end of the day, our God, the Lord, speaks and summons the earth. That's how this psalm begins. And it says, "Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines forth." You can read that. Maybe is Zion out of Zion, which is the perfection of beauty. But I think you could also read it, "Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty is God who shines forth." And either way, the focus is on beauty. So I'm struck by the beauty of creation as our context, and then there's this sense of beauty, and it's that God is somehow seen in beauty. And we're used to talking about God in terms of goodness, like God is good, or justice, God is just, or love, God is love, or gracious grace and mercy. We don't often talk about God as being beautiful, or about beauty as revealing something of the character and substance of God. And yet that's where the psalmist starts. I mean, this psalmist invites us to think about God as being beautiful and the beauty of God and that experience. Because when you have that experience of beauty, if you think about any kind of natural experience you've had out there where you have been in a state of awe and just astonishment, and your response is just delight and joy in the face of real beauty. It's not just the natural world. I mean, you could go to a symphony concert or a good jazz trio or even a secular band and feel the kind of, when it's done well and the kind of emotion it stirs, and your response is want to applaud. And why do we applaud? We applaud out of a sense of gratitude. It's a sense of thankfulness for what we just experienced. Right? Or, you know, the plate of food that comes, you're at this great restaurant and this plate of food and you're just amazed and astonished and you're so moved that you take out your smartphone and you know, take a picture and post it to Facebook before you eat, right? I mean, that's your response to the beauty of the food and everything that it stimulates, you know, before you. We're geared to delight, to experience delight and joy in the face of beauty. And our response is gratitude often. This applause that happens. This psalmist gets it. We read the first 6 verses, and then it continues in verse 7. "Hear, O my people, and I will speak, O Israel. I will testify against you. I am your God. And not for your sacrifices do I rebuke you, or your burnt offerings are continually before me. This psalm is written in a time in Israel when the temple is in existence. And in the temple, the Temple Mount was a place where you brought bulls, calves, goats, sheep, doves to be sacrificed. And they were sacrificed right there, and there were channels in the floor to accommodate literally the river of blood that would be taken away. And then this huge kind of pit in the center on the dais, you would go up and the carcasses of the animals were thrown in, and the smoke that would be going up to God, right? This was worship in ancient Israel. And God's saying, I'm not upset with you because of your sacrifices. You're doing them. You're following through. Like you're offering your sacrifices continually. You're offering your sacrifices religiously. But God is saying, you know what? I'm not going to accept your bulls from your house or the goats from your folds. For every wild animal in the forest is mine. The cattle on 1,000 hills, I know all the birds of the air, and the fowl that moves on the field is mine. God's saying, I've created this world. I delight in the bear in the forest and the antelope running on the plain and the wild birds, right? And the fish in the sea. I don't need your animals. I don't need your sacrifices. And this is actually an astonishing statement for the psalmist to be making. It's a really progressive kind of theological statement in the context. It's a critique of the sacrificial system. That maybe God doesn't like our sacrifices. That maybe God isn't actually hungry for our sacrifices. So it continues, if I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and all that is in it is mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls? Do I drink the blood of goats? Rather, offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving and pay your vows to the Most High. Call on me in the day of trouble. I will deliver you and you shall glorify me. And the sacrifice that God desires is a sacrifice of thanksgiving. It's gratitude. Which is a curious, that's a profound statement actually for the psalmist to be making. And it's that sense, and this isn't, the danger is reading this psalm in the sense of the sacrificial language. Like, well, I don't want your bulls, I don't want your goats, I want you to be thankful. Right? You better be thankful because of all the good things I've given you. And we read it with that tone. You know, it's like being a parent and you tell your kid, no, say thank you. And your kid says thank you. And the reason why they're saying thank you is because you told them to say thank you, but not because they're thankful, right? That's not the idea here. I mean, the idea here is that moment where your kid comes to you and you've given your kid something and they say out of the spontaneous joy at what you've just given them, thank you, Mommy. I mean, it's the delight that they feel. And then it's your delight in their delight. That actually, I think, is part of what God is getting at. It's like, I delight in your delight. I delight in that moment where you are just so astonished by what's happening that you applaud what's going on. That actually gives God joy. That's the sacrifice that God desires. Not the blood of bulls and the blood of lambs, but it's that mutual recognition and the interplay of like the delighting in the goodness of the world. And then the psalm goes on to talk about those who don't have any integrity in their worship, and then it closes, those who bring thanksgiving as their sacrifice honor me. To those who go the right way, I will show the salvation of God. And again, the psalm ends in thanksgiving. So as we think about this and think about giving and the role of gratitude and this applause that arises spontaneously for the goodness of our lives, I want to look at a couple of things, show a couple of videos here, because gratitude's a thing right now.
Totally up to you. It's gratitude. Gratitude is much more than saying thanks. It's a way of seeing the world. And with practice, we can train ourselves to feel gratitude more frequently and powerfully. The scientific evidence is clear. Practicing gratitude is good for you and your loved ones. Grateful people get sick less, have healthier hearts, exercise more, get better sleep. Grateful people are more optimistic, overcome adversity better, find greater joy in life. Grateful people are more generous with their time and money, are more forgiving, and build better relationships with loved ones. Just like strengthening muscles, you can build gratitude simply by exercising it. So, how do you develop an attitude of gratitude? Take the first step now. Write a letter to someone you know and tell them why you are grateful for them. Or think about the blessings you may take for granted. Or start a gratitude journal at elementsofgratitude.org and get serious about becoming more grateful. Thanks for watching.
So for anyone who's, for the sake of our internet, the recording of this, that's a YouTube video entitled Gratitude is Good for You. If the people listening online want to hear it, watch it. What did that stir? What did you see? Louder. Too simplistic. All right, Gene, why? I appreciate the skepticism, and the astonishment at it. Actually, each of those numbers that they gave you in terms of better stress and better sleep and all that are actually based in scientific research. So they've been doing scientific research on being in a state of gratitude and how that affects your health. So actually, it's not just one scientific study. It's a whole series of scientific studies that are being done in different places. So that's where this is coming from. It's not just a feel-good kind of thing. It's they're actually discovering that, you have less stress, you have better relationships, you're happier, you have lower blood pressure. Actually gratitude is physically good for you. Other responses? Nothing to do with religion. Okay. Yeah, right. You don't have to believe in anything for this. It's just a thing, right?
Doesn't have to be related to God.
To be grateful and you can be better. Yeah, Gabby. It's the power of positive thinking. Partially. I don't think it's not unconnected. If there is no spiritual connection, it could be just the power of positive thinking. I'm going to suggest that gratitude is more than that. But I think in terms of how this video presents it, you're probably right. Yeah. Back there? Yeah. Yep. And it is an attitude that you cultivate. It's an attitude you develop over time. It's just a one-time event. It's a way of being in the world. And I imagine they're doing it in the schools because the science is showing, hey, this is a good way to raise kids, right? Anybody else? Rose. Yep. Yep. That's how you live it out. Yeah. So, I appreciated the comment that there is no connection to spirituality with this. There doesn't necessarily need to be a connection to spirituality. This was just focused very much on gratitude. What our psalmist did, what Psalm 50 did, though, is it linked gratitude to beauty. Right? It was the beauty of God, the perfection of beauty, that was this connection with gratitude. It's that experience of something that's beautiful or astonishing that leads to delight, that leads to joy, that leads to the applause. That is the expression of gratitude, right? So this next video, I think, captures that connection. And for anyone listening online, the video is, again, a YouTube video. It's called Gratitude, the short film by Louis Schwartzberg. He does, I think, a brilliant job of connecting gratitude with beauty. And so pay attention as you watch this video to the role that beauty is playing in its connection to gratitude. It's going to open up with a very short clip of a girl, and she's making a contrast between watching TV and going out into the world and exploring the world, and the difference between sitting there watching TV and going out and exploring the world. So what'd you see? What did that stir in you? Yeah, Shauna. So it's a shift in thinking from abundance, the abundance that we have, rather than coming from a place of scarcity, what we don't have. Yeah. Anyone else? Yeah, Antoinette. Oh, it has been going around. Okay. Good. Good to know. This is the first time I saw it. Last night was the first time I saw it. Wonder. And I love that, right? Yeah. I mean, because that's what beauty does. I think that's ultimately, that's why he makes that connection to beauty in a way that the first one didn't. And he doesn't talk about God either in this video, but it's definitely, this is a more deeply spiritual sort of video, but he makes that connection between the wonder that's evoked of the beauty, I mean, the beauty of the landscapes. Like, he's a well-known cinematographer. He's well-known in terms of having developed time-lapse photography. And so the visions of the flowers opening and closing and the strawberry ripening and the cloud formations, he's a pioneer in that. So he's well-known. I mean, he did a film in, I think, 2012 about wings. I think it was about birds or something. But anyway, I mean, it's all about time-lapse photography. And what he said is he never gets tired of watching a flower open and close. The time-lapse that he does, like, he never gets tired of the wonder of it. Yeah. Others. Yeah, the first was like, this is a good thing for you, you need to be doing it, do it. Go for it. This was an invitation into, no, the goodness of your world. It's the reason why we're grateful, right? You gave us a reason to be grateful. Yeah, John. Yeah, being surrounded, being mindful of what's happening in the moment. Someone in the early service said just being grateful even for just the little things that are right before us. Like being able to watch a strawberry ripen. over time, right? Out of your strawberry patch, and just the beauty of that. I promised I would connect this to the Transfiguration. So I don't want to let you down. I know you've been sitting there thinking, okay, what does this have to do with the Transfiguration? But it got me thinking differently when understanding the beauty of God and the perfection of the beauty of God, and that's a category of understanding God in a way of our understanding the divine. It occurred to me that from the perspective of the first hearers of this story and the writers of this story, that blinding light, that Jesus goes up there on the top of the mountain, and all of a sudden there is this blinding, white, pure, intense light that's just coming from him. And those ancient hearers, I mean, those people who are shaped by Psalm 50 would have seen that as this is the holiness of God, this is the righteousness of God, but this is ultimately the beauty of God that is shining forth in that moment. And it's so intense, we can't even see it. We don't even have eyes that have the capacity to fully understand the beauty of God. We need it refracted. We need it refracted like stained glass, right? That's what stained glass does, is it takes the intensity of the light and helps us see the beauty inherent in it. And it made me wonder, is Jesus in this moment like a stained glass, a piece of stained glass, where the beauty of God is just shining? I mean, Jesus, in some sense, is this stained glass, and the beauty of God just shines. Except, I mean, it kind of breaks down because this is a moment where the veil is unpeeled and it's so blinding we can't see it. And Peter and James and John are confused. But then it goes back. And there's something of the goodness of God that's being shown. Jesus is that liminal kind of space, in some sense. That's what I'm working with right now. I mean, that's my best explanation for the Transfiguration. And I'm going to go with it. So we can talk more if you want. But that's what I got. Do you mind?